Alcoholic. Let me get a good look at you all. And then I'm going to take my glasses off because then I'm blind and I can't see. So there we go. Bye. No, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. And I was just asked yesterday to come up and speak by my friend who doesn't really come to this meeting. She's from like way that way. And I was like, sure, I'd be happy to. And then I was like, you mean me speak? Me first? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, cool, sure, that's fine. I love speaking for Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't really get nervous. I feel a little adrenaline. You know, it's exciting to be asked to speak. But my mother was a politician, and my father was a salesman. So I grew up kind of getting dragged around to all different kinds of campaign, booths and, you know, just the Republican Party back in those days. This was in Connecticut, you know, back in the 60s and the 70s, and I was a little kid. And it just always seemed kind of natural and exciting to me. So I'm quite happy to be asked to speak and to come up. And, I hope I say something that that you all haven't heard before, although the first important thing I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I'm nobody special, right? And I say this to people, and they're like, oh, no, Jackie, you're special. You're special. And I'm like, no, you don't know what I mean. You know, I have alcoholism, and it's a disease, and I didn't ask for it, and I didn't know I had it. I knew I had a really bad drinking problem. That became obvious, but I was pretty good at hiding that. But I didn't know about the nature of alcoholism and about what it meant to be self-centered. You know, I knew I always wanted to get more, you know, like every kid. And as I got older, I was very concerned with myself and my fun. And that's selfishness. But I didn't know about how how the self-centered aspect of the disease really twists those of us that are alcoholic. And it's me and it's people that I've worked with I've seen it in. And I think we all have it, you know. And it says in the big book that we'll never be like other people. And my sobriety date is June 9, 1999. So I've been sober for a while, and I've been going to meetings that whole time. I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not my first time in Alcoholics Anonymous trying to get sober. I'd been on the wagon countless times. I'd been to AA probably 5 or 6 years before before I finally, you know, put down the drink. And I think pretty much the vast majority of us do that. When I hear somebody who's new say, I'm a chronic relapser, I always say, well, really, that just makes you a proper alcoholic. You know, we all do that. And it's very frustrating and shaming and all of that, you know, to be determined to put it down and to not be able to. But that's part of the disease, too. Again, it's a genetic bullet. This is what I've come to learn. And it centers in the mind, you know, the mind and the body. And, you know, for me, this learning about this kind of self-centered, this twisted self-centered thinking that I have it's become really fascinating the more that I've matured as a person and gotten older and stayed sober longer and heard my story from other people, whether I was taking them through the steps or heard them from the podium. And there are spiritual principles that we learn from doing the steps, and we've all probably heard about those. And I can remember when I went through the big book with a sponsor, I was about 8 years sober. We didn't really like the big book where I got sober. I didn't like it, and the people I hung out with didn't like it, so we didn't bother with it too much. There was the culture of AA where I was, and there may have been people who were becoming enlightened on the edges of that community, but I wasn't interested in it, and we kind of dismissed them, you know, as being know-it-alls or, you know, God, like God Squad, we used to call them. But I heard a guy share at a meeting. This was over in New Jersey, and he said something that really got my attention. You know, and I used to sit in the back. I had my hombres, and we'd go to the diner. And, you know, I was 8 years sober. I had had some significant experiences in AA and some degree of spiritual awakening. But I had never been held to any kind of standard, which I think is what going through the steps out of the Big Book with a sponsor does. That's what it did for me. But I heard this guy share, and he was one of the guys that started this meeting years ago, and 10 years ago almost now. And I heard him say, AA becomes interesting when you get out of the way. And you're not in AA for yourself, you're in AA to help others. And I don't know if I had never heard this before or whether it spoke to me, you know, hearing him speak in front of this group, not a super friendly crowd for a Big Book thumper, the culture of this area. And it really kind of polarized my little community, me on one side and, as I remember it, all of my friends on the other side, you know, but it spoke to me and it woke me up somehow, and I ended up starting to come up here to Feet First, and I was so blown away by the stories that I heard the speakers talk about here. I also thought it was really weird that there was no sharing, you know, because like my hand would want to shoot up. I'd want to share in the middle of the speaker. It was very moving, but I started to hear the story over and over again about going through the steps out of the Big Book, as laid out in the Big Book, with a sponsor who's been through that experience with a person before them. And I wanted that. So I found a sponsor, and I went through the steps, and mountains were moved, you know. And I'm getting chills right now when I think about it, because I was a really tough nut to crack. I was a really... you know, I was like a rather fierce person in my interior life, rather fierce and very vulnerable. You know, those two things always somehow, there's always somehow kind of these opposing forces. Like growing up, my image of myself was I didn't wear any makeup. I never followed any trends. I was a t-shirt and jeans girl, but I always wanted to be the center of attention. So, you know, stuff like that, like, I really, really wanted to just be completely inconspicuous, but I also always wanted to win every argument and be right. So there were, you know, like, I was very confused about who I was and what I thought. I was very focused on what was going on out there, and if she can be slightly overweight and be happy and popular, why can't I be? Or if she can be, you know, I'm epileptic, if she can be epileptic and still be cool, why can't I be? You know, like, I just didn't know who I was. I was dreadfully afraid of being at home with nothing to do on Saturday night, which was a lot of the time what happened. You know, stuff like that, those were my markers. How many Christmas parties did I get invited to? That was my barometer of how well I was doing socially in my life. And if they were the more opulent dress-up Christmas parties, that was really good. You know, I could tell other people, I'd be, you know. So those were my standards for how my life was going. And really, I was 39 years old when I got sober, and secretly those things were extremely important to me. And if I didn't meet my own standards, I felt great shame, you know. Just a little bit about my drinking, what it was like. I was a blackout drinker. I was raised in a pretty strict, traditional household, and women, you know, in this whatever tradition, were supposed to be ladies, ladylike, and where drinking took me a lot was making out with strangers in dark doorways and waking up the next day and going, oh my God, I did it again. Like my, you know, the thing I would just die if everyone found out about was the thing that I was doing. And I would go on the wagon for a couple of weeks, and then I would pick up a drink. And 2 weeks later, I was waiting till everybody went to bed and sneaking out to go across the river to New Hope, to go to mostly to the gay bars, but because then I thought, you know, oh, I was safe. Like, no one will try to pick me up there. But this is what ended up happening all the time. And it was so much against my principles as a person. But for whatever reason, and I was married. I had two children. I remember one time being over in the cartwheel at 2 a.m. on a Thursday night. And I was involved with the school board. You know, I had two little kids in this school system. And for some reason, my neighbor was in there. And he was like, "What are you doing in here?" And I was like, "Oh, my God." You know, I was completely seeing double, drunk, dancing like a crazy person. And, you know, I knew all that whole time when the drinking was really bad, which was really like the last 9 years of my drinking, that sooner or later everything was going to crash together and everyone was going to find out. And, you know, I would have to wear my shame publicly. And as long as I could keep it a secret, I guess I felt like I was powerless against it, which I was. We all are. But, you know, now looking back, I think people knew. I just don't think they knew what to do, because there was no stopping me. When I started drinking, you know, I'd have a couple of drinks, and I'd get that, like, pure adrenaline rush, and it was, get out of my way. I'm going out. And I would hear the motorcycles riding up and down the highway, and I would just feel like life is passing me by. You know, here I had these two little children, and I had this beautiful little house, and, you know, I had the privilege of a lot of really good education, and I didn't, you know, we're powerless over alcohol. We can't resist this for whatever reason, the allergy, you know, but I had it bad, and it completely controlled my life, and it was pretty miserable. It wasn't any fun anymore. It was pretty miserable. So I got sober, and I went to AA, and the whole how I got sober was kind of funny, too. I sort of secretly snuck off to the psychiatrist and had this evaluation, and off the record, you know, didn't want it on my permanent record, and she said, you know, alcohol might be a problem for you, and I was like, not really. And she was like, well, if it is, you can go to AA. And I was like, oh, God, AA, not AA. I don't want to go to AA. But I ended up doing that, eventually did. And you know, in the beginning, I got involved with this pretty cool group of people. They replaced my drinking friends, and they were wonderful to me. And we had fun, and we hung out. And for that first 8 years, I didn't drink. I didn't really even want to drink. You know, I was done with the drinking part of it, but I really hadn't started with the God part of it. I just thought there was something creepy and corrupt about the whole God thing. And I wasn't going to, like, I just didn't have time for it. So then, you know, I hear this guy speak. His name was Greg. And I never really saw him again until more recently. I didn't get to know him really well, but you know, there are some people who are just kind of magical with this spirituality thing. It wasn't threatening to me. It wasn't condescending or pretentious. It was just like, whatever that is, I want that. I need that. Suddenly, I don't know what it is, but I need it. So I ended up actually getting remarried and moving to this area. And for a number of years, I came up here all the time. You know, I came up here pretty much every Monday to listen to the stories. And, you know, I just for a second want to say, like, it's just so awesome that, I mean, there's a really strong home group here, and there's just such an incredible commitment to having this meeting here for those of us who find it and come here and kind of get swept up in this wave of spiritual awakening, which is the result of practicing the steps as laid out in the big book, but it's also the result of being around other people who are discovering it and hearing people like me talk about it. So it's really important, and you know, I'm very grateful for this meeting. It's been huge in my life. So So yeah, I went through the steps, and I've got to say the sixth step, which had always really kind of been dismissed, six and seven, were so unbelievably huge for me at this time. You know, the sit alone, and I think it's the first time I ever sat comfortably alone by myself. And I remember it was in my kitchen, and I wasn't expecting anything from it, you know, and I had this amazing, amazing, amazing fifth step experience with the sponsor. I had, for the first time in my life, been able to look at myself, and I was like, oh, I was really kind of blown away by what my behavior looked like and what my motives were. I didn't know. I kind of secretly knew that you know, I would torture people and I used people like we all do. But I always kind of thought it was cool, you know? Like, I was always trying to get over there with those cool people who could blow people off and people still wanted to hang out with them, you know? And it didn't really work that way for me. But you know, when I was able to really see this for the first time, suddenly it didn't seem so appealing anymore, the way I lived and the way I thought about the world and the resources that I needed and how I got them. And I started to see other things that were character flaws. And I had been for 8 years listening to people talk about character flaws. And I was like, what character flaws? Fear. I was like, what fear? I would walk into an after-hours club in Manhattan, completely drunk, and go right into the bathroom to look for the worst criminal who had the best drugs. I'd be like, I'm not afraid of anything, honestly. But I didn't know what fear was, you know, what it really was. There's this line in the Big Book, fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. It sets in motion trains of circumstances that come back to hurt us, but did we not set the ball rolling? And, you know, this was really true for me, making that fears list in the preparation for the, you know, during the fourth step and preparation for the fifth step, you know, and this sponsor, for some reason, completely set me at ease. I was able to be honest for the first time. And I remember this specifically with this fears list, because the fears on my list were really kind of ridiculous and embarrassing. They were, I'm afraid of dying alone. I'm afraid of being poor. I'm afraid of being old and alone. Most of it was poor and alone, ugly and alone, old and alone, you know, alone. And, you know, I could see how I had clenched onto these people through my life, not because I wanted to give them, you know, not because I wanted to give them anything, but because I had this intense fear, this fear of abandonment. And I've never been abandoned. My parents were great. You know, I think it's an alcoholic thing. Maybe all humans have it. I don't know. Most of the people that I work with, it's an issue that comes up. And it's a word that you hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And up to that point, I was like, oh, fear, give me a break. What are we all afraid of? And, you know, I used to go into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and listen to these guys share about emotional things. And I'd be like, oh, my God, what is wrong with these men? They're supposed to be men. You know, it made me so uncomfortable to hear men talk about feelings. You know, like, that's not manly. It's just really pathetic. And, you know, now I go, there are several meetings I attend regularly. And one of the meetings is a Big Book study where I hear these young, they're like these young, beautiful, tough guys. They're mostly guys. They're in their early 20s. And to hear them talk about the Big Book, it just melts my heart. You know, I'm so different now. To hear them talk about God and to share about how this, you know, this spiritual awareness is becoming available to them and it's working its way into their interior life, into their thinking, it just absolutely melts my heart and it makes me feel connected to them, even though I don't know a lot of them. And I don't really, you know, I don't work with young men, take them through the steps and all that kind of thing. But it doesn't really matter. It's like this, it's the fellowship, I guess. It's the really, I'm part of this. I'm part of AA. I was never a joiner. I was always cynical, critical, sarcastic, apart, despite the fact that I wanted to be the most popular and the coolest and the one everybody was calling all the time. You know, there again is another one of these opposing things. Like, I want to be nasty so that people will think I'm really hard to be friends with, so they'll try harder. You know, those were my strategies growing up. Didn't really work, but sometimes they did. Like the neediest, most vulnerable people, that kind of stuff works with, you know. And then you can really torture those people. You know, as far as being a part of something, I never really was. I was tall, super skinny, long hair down to my pockets. Went to all these Grateful Dead shows, never felt comfortable, never felt relaxed and comfortable. Maybe one show I did, and that's like my best memory from my whole life. But just never felt connected or felt like a normal person fitting in. And, you know, art school. Went to, you know, I had the opportunity to go to this school and do a lot of things in New York with really famous artists and famous people, and I always felt so awkward and uncomfortable and like, my wig was on crooked. You know, I could never think of anything to talk about. It was horrible. I was so anxious. But I didn't know it. You know, I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I was not a joiner. And I'm still a person of a lot of solitude. And these days, my interior life is a much more pleasant place to be. I know this about myself. Like, I could care less if I don't have a lot of social things to trot off to. In fact, I choose not to do a lot of things because I don't really want to. I love my space and my home, and I spend in my professional work, I spend a lot of time alone, and that's okay. You know, according to the rules back then, it would have been another reason why I was a complete loser. You know, but today, I kind of know my truth, and I've been able to relax about a lot of those outside things that I used to try so hard to cram into my agenda. Yeah, I do feel connected. I've had a couple of really profound spiritual awakenings, you know, moments of connectedness. I think I've probably been able to have these experiences because of prayer and meditation, because I've had a discipline of prayer and meditation as I was told to, you know, in the 11th step and in the 10th step, you know, looking at like something is eating my lunch. Really can't stop thinking about it, like what's going on with that, what in me is causing me to have this corrosive, angry interior dialogue. I also went through something really, really painful over the past 2 years, and I really had to interact with people that, you know, from my past it was very painful. And I learned somewhere, probably from one of the people that I go to for support, to say, you know, this infamous, kind of hostile and manipulative information, behavior is coming at me, and I've learned to say, that simply isn't the experience I'm having. You may be having that experience of me, but it simply isn't the experience I'm having. You know, rather than getting in there and duking it out and arguing and screaming and getting really furious. So the steps, that later part of this, part of the steps has been immensely reparative to me. And like I said before, I know I'm not ever going to be like other people who are just naturally calm and good. You know, I'm not ever going to be like that. I'm an alcoholic. I'm still wired with this same thing I always had growing up, this an inability to see things clearly because I am, you know, I'm taking up this much space in the issue and everybody else, you know, is just, everybody else is just coming, behaving at me, behaving because of me, you know, it's all their fault, the whole thing. I mean, anybody who's done step work with people is familiar with this me syndrome. You know, I still have this. But these days, I have, and I still, you know, I still sometimes really, really struggle with painful things that I have to go through. I did, you know, recently put in a lot of time sitting with Emmett Fox and reading. Emmett Fox is a writer. He was a motivational speaker. And he was somebody that Bill Wilson and his crew really leaned on a lot when they were writing the Big Book. It must have been revolutionary at the time. I mean, I don't really know that much about him academically, but he wrote about the Lord's Prayer, and he wrote about the whole Bible as a vortex for each individual to have access to this kind of divine, clean, spiritual energy and truth. And he also, what I get out of it is that the Bible and all the different literary vehicles in the Bible, there's poetry, there are narrative stories, there are, you know, all of the different parts of the Bible, they're all metaphors for what's going on inside my head. And it was his position that they're not meant to make us walk around identifying, like, you know, wars and pestilent people. It's all about what's happening inside my head. And I can get really jammed up with what's going on inside my head, or I can read just about anything from the Bible or the Lord's Prayer and understand that I'm crazy, a little bit crazy all the time, especially because I'm an alcoholic, it makes it worse. But if I believe what my mind is telling me, I'm going to behave badly. And I can no longer afford to match bad behavior with bad behavior as a sober alcoholic. And as a gangster for God, which is what I tell my girls, you know, we can no longer afford to dabble in the human realm of hostility and, you know, bad behavior, being rude, being manipulative, being jealous, all those the character flaws that come up. We cannot afford to follow through on any of the impulses that come from these character flaws because, A, they're imaginary, you know, a lot of it. Sometimes there's a real issue. And, you know, we have actual, real, honest tool for that, and that is to share our truth. And that's not always easy, especially if you're a trained manipulator like I am or a people pleaser or an enabler. You know, and I was all that stuff. Sometimes it's very uncomfortable to share the truth honestly with somebody. When you speak to me that way, I don't feel welcome here. That's a truth. Do with that whatever you want to do. But that's my truth. I'm not saying this at the person. I'm just saying my problem is that when you speak to me that way, I don't feel welcome here. You know, I've learned so much about having relationships, sharing honestly, you know, with my partner, even when it's really uncomfortable. And I'll say sometimes, I need to say something and I know it's not going to be popular. But this is my truth and this is my information. And if I don't share this information with you, you're not going to know why I'm acting this way. You know, because I'm not perfect yet and I'm not all like drunk on God and no good to anyone on earth. Either. I've never really been able to get there. That will come later, hopefully. But and I don't mean to be disrespectful in saying that, but you know, I'm just, tend to be a melancholy, kind of an isolator, still kind of cynical, still kind of sarcastic, you know, and I really need these spiritual principles to keep me from behaving badly with people that I care about, people I don't want to hurt, or people that I don't like for whatever reason, and I do want to hurt them. You know, I cannot afford to do that anymore because it consumes my interior dialogue to a profound degree for long periods of time, and I'm no good to anybody, and I can't work. And, you know, I could used to be able to get myself, so I'm a jewelry designer, and I work with this saw frame, and it has a little tiny saw blade, and the saw blades are like a dollar each. And I used to sit out in my studio, and I would get myself so worked up, I'd start chewing on some issue, and I'd be breaking these saw blades, and I'd be like, my God, I can't do that, you know, I can't afford to break a dozen saw blades over having this altercation. I'm practicing for the altercation that I hope is coming because I really want to get this information out there. Or I'm renovating the last altercation where I just didn't quite have it together to be as brutal as I really needed to be, you know. And I understand that now that's all playing God. You know, I never got that either when people would say, oh, it's ego. Oh, you're playing God. I'd be like, what are you talking about? But just about everything that's unpleasant to me, I see now as playing God. You know, anything that's pretense, pretentiousness, anything that is the least bit dishonest, if I exaggerate, you know, the first time I spoke in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was at this Tuesday night meeting in Lambertville, this Tuesday 9 o'clock meeting, and it was like all bikers and, you know, kind of, I liked it there. It was dark. It was like a bar almost. It was real dark, and everyone was kind of, you know, laid back and a little rough, and I just thought I was like this high-class princess who was coming in to tell, you know, make them all jealous of me or whatever, and I tell the story about the house I grew up in and the fountains and the horses in the backyard, and none of that was true. None of it was true, you know, and they hated me. Like, years later, they would say, Jackie, you were so obnoxious when you first came in here, like, I couldn't stand you. And I'd be like, oh, thank you for telling me that, you know. But what I was doing was I was playing my own God. I wasn't good enough or interesting enough or wealthy enough or beautiful enough or anything enough. So I was creating this story to make everything bigger and better. And I did this all the time with everything, you know, and I was playing God, you know, my who I am, the fact of who I am, plainly, my strengths and weaknesses were never interesting or big enough or bad enough or, you know, never enough, so I embellished on them, and I embellished on everything, and if I wanted to be helpful to somebody, I would try to, you know, force them to do what I thought they should do, and I would get mad if they didn't do it. And that's playing God, too. You know, if I wanted to force somebody to be my friend forever, I would be super generous, and then I would, you know, there were strings attached, and that's playing God, too. I wanted to be worshipped. And I, you know, I never got that. And I really wasn't, I'm kind of exaggerating now, I really wasn't that bad. But I would be like, what is all this playing God about? Like, it sounded so stupid to me. And I came to see that I did that all the time as an alcoholic. It was my ego. It was my sense of self. I needed to be bigger. I needed to be better. I needed to be heard. I needed to be right. And if I wasn't, I was left alone with my interior mind, you know, really feeling profoundly sad and miserable. And, of course, drinking gave me that. You know, I drank straight vodka, room temperature, no ice, out of a jelly glass in the end. And I'd knock back that jelly glass of vodka, and for about 15 seconds I felt like amazing. Like I was an amazing person, I had an amazing life, and I was just like such hot shit, and maybe no one knew it, but it didn't matter because I just felt like I just felt really good. I felt better. And of course, then I would continue drinking all night, black out, sneak off the property, go out to the bars, come back at 4 a.m, and be horribly hungover the whole next day. But you know, the drinking was kind of the neutralizer of that interior life, of the insecurity of that interior life, and the low self-esteem that comes along with being an alcoholic. Because when you're doing that kind of drinking on a regular basis, it's really hard to be a solid, responsible, highly functioning person. It was hard for me in the end. You know, I could fake it, and I could tell these big stories. I got really good at that. But I always had the feeling that my credibility was a little bit wobbly, and maybe people didn't really believe everything I said because everything was pretty dramatic, you know. And you know, when I understood the spiritual principle of honesty and the idea of be true to yourself, suddenly it just didn't make sense to me anymore. You know, the whole concept, this whole project of getting myself to a certain place in life where I could be comfortable seemed like that line in the Big Book. You know, did I not set the ball rolling? Do these things not come back to harm me? And do I not set the ball rolling? You know, suddenly it all started to make sense. And I had access to this kind of new place where I could just be. I didn't have to be anybody special. I didn't have to meet these phantom expectations of my parents or outperform my contemporaries, you know, the people I grew up with. I'm not really in touch with any of those people anymore. They're phantoms. I was able to just kind of rest, you know, and it was really what Emmett Fox gave me. Emmett Fox gave me a way into a lot of spiritual writings. And number one, the Christian Bible, which I had always, like, if you had said, oh, this is in the Bible, my eyes would roll already. Be like, oh my God, don't even, like, I want nothing to do with that. Because I don't like being told what to do. A lot of alcoholics don't. I don't like being bossed around. I don't like criticism. I don't like authority, you know, because I don't know it, but I'm playing God. Like, I'm God, not you. Like, you know, you just don't get it. And now I understand that, you know, there's God in all of us. And I work with young women, and they kind of drive me crazy because I can see them doing the exact things I did in early sobriety, with relationships, just with, you know, the path that we're all on. And the people back in those days who were like, oh my God, Jackie, you were so obnoxious, they saw it in me. And no one kicked me out of AA for being annoying or for behaving like an idiot. No one kicked me out of AA. And I want to thank all of you for that. And I have to be patient and tolerant with, you know, with everybody that I come across. And it's getting better. There used to be certain individuals, there were like a handful of individuals in AA meetings that I just couldn't stand. Couldn't stand the way they talked. Couldn't stand the way they talked like they wrote the Big Book and they knew every word. And I would, you know, sit there and I would actively ignore them. I would shun them from my seat in the AA meeting. And I know, I was like, oh, I just couldn't help it. And, you know, gradually, I didn't take any action on any, you know, I didn't walk up and tell anyone off, thank God. But, I can be, like, I was raised by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. I know how to insult somebody so that they don't know they've been insulted until later, you know. And I used to do that where I could. Felt like it was kind of my job. But I am... you know, I just trusted that I'm not supposed to be doing this kind of stuff anymore. Like, I am no one special. That to me was such a gift, that concept. Like, I latched on to that idea, and it was kind of through that idea that I explored some of the these other spiritual principles. You know, like in this case with these people, I had, they were resentments. You know, it was another thing. I'd be like, resentment? I don't have any resentments. Like, I hate everybody. I don't like anybody. You know, I don't care about anybody. I don't have resentments. But I had, you know, these are resentments against people in meetings, people that I was getting to know and people who I had to share the floor with. When they raised their hand and it was their turn to share, I had to sit there and listen, you know, and I ended up like, and with a couple of other conflicts, I ended up doing this experiment where I didn't respond, I didn't take any action, kind of hung back and let the thing play out without any interference, without getting in anyone's face, without really talking about it, gossiping about it or whatever. And it was hard, you know, it's not easy for a person like me, but at the other end of that, I ended up coming out of it without having been a part of it really. You know, and with these handful of, there's always a handful of people that bug me, you know. I mean, honestly, don't we all have that? I've ended up being able to coast through those things, and those people are some of the people I love the most now, you know, from the people in the community. I wanted to talk a little bit about compassion, too. You know, compassion is just such a lovely, wonderful thing. It's like the key to everything for me sometimes. And Emmett Fox talks a lot about compassion. And the Dalai Lama, of course, talks a lot about compassion. I was not capable of having compassion for anything. And I'm probably still not. But I was not capable of having compassion for anything I hadn't been through myself. Right? So I remember like 20 years ago or whatever, I would see these things like, if you take this herb, it'll improve your memory. And I'd be like, what's all this about memory, for God's sake? I mean, why do you need to remember anything anyway? Well, I'm older now, and I have these, like, moments where the word, I know the word, but I can't think of it. And where, you know, like, things are slipping a little bit. And it's age appropriate, right? Well, you can ask. As people who are close to me, they roll their eyes. But it's age appropriate. But I understand now. I'm connected, suddenly connected to all of the other people who have ever had the feeling that they're aging and that their memory is slipping. It's like suddenly I love those people. You know, I feel like, yeah, it kind of sucks. There are things about aging that aren't great. But there's so much love there. You know, there's so much of a feeling of loving and being connected to the other humans that are, we're all just blobs of cellular material running around on the planet doing the best that we can with the tools that we have. You know, and I'm just one just like everybody else is. I also have, both of my parents are gone, and I have two children, and I've just had a lot of these bittersweet moments where I remember what I was like as an adolescent and as an adult and how entitled I was to my parents' resources and, you know, their homes and their whatever financial help I could wrangle out of them, which was, you know, they were very generous people. But I, you know, I see those things playing out in my daughters, and it's not upsetting to me, you know. So, I mean, sometimes my daughter, I don't want to talk about them behind their backs because I could totally adore them, and not just things in them, but things in other friends of mine, like their character flaws, I guess. I see them operating with these character flaws, whatever they may be. And it makes me feel so connected to my parents because I was the worst. I mean, I was so selfish and I was nasty, you know. And I feel like if I can forgive everybody right now for the behavior that I think is inappropriate, maybe I can find forgiveness for all of those years of behaving like a really screwed up, selfish, alcoholic. I don't know if I'm explaining this very well, but I find a great deal of forgiveness there in this idea of compassion. And when I go through something painful, what I get in the end of it, especially if I resist the urge to get in there and duke it out, if it's with another person or a group of people, what I find at the end of it is that I get compassion. It is available to me now. And it softens me and it melts that, you know, that upset and angry beast that's alcoholic, the alcoholic part of me. It's the thing that dissipates my character flaws, this compassion. Like somebody's doing something and it's really making me furious. Compassion tells me, go where they are. Find a time in your life at some point where you did the same thing. And there's always one. It may not be exactly the same, but there's always a similar circumstance. I always had similar feelings to any bad behavior. Why were you behaving that way? And it's usually because I was afraid of being alone. I was afraid of dying alone. I was afraid of being unpopular. I was afraid of being made to feel stupid. I was afraid of being excluded. I was afraid I wasn't going to get my whatever. I was jealous. I was, you know, all of the character flaws. The information about myself is in there. And I have a way in now. And that's God to me. My ability to beam up a little bit up outside of my worldly self. And it's like I have this filing system now that I've learned from doing the steps, from prayer and meditation, from turning to God when I'm really, really disturbed and afraid, and finding through these spiritual principles what is the right way to understand this. It almost always comes back to compassion, which is something that I completely lacked. So, thank God I'm out of time. Thank you for having me, and God bless everybody.